Artificial intelligence is advancing at an unprecedented rate and changing the world as it goes. On this special episode of Science Will Win, we're sharing one of a series of conversations recorded live at the Pfizer Podcasting Lounge at South by Southwest. We're talking about the role AI is playing in reshaping the landscape of cancer care. AI expert, investor, and host of season 3 of Science Will Win, Jeremiah Aoyang, moderated a panel with three cancer healthcare luminaries: Julie Gerberding, CEO of the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health; Ed Cox, head of digital health and medicines at Pfizer; and Mema Carmo, founder of the Tiger Lily Foundation. Together, they explored the transformative potential of AI in reshaping the trajectory of cancer treatment. 30 years ago, the notion of eradicating cancer seemed distant, much like the emergence of AI in healthcare. There are so many ways that AI can help make cancer care more equitable, personalized, and effective, as well as potentially speed up research on new treatments. The panelists explored how AI is poised to redefine our approach to cancer, offering insights into the latest breakthroughs, their personal experiences with healthcare, and the collective vision for a future where we can outdo cancer. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to South by Southwest. Thanks all for coming to the podcast lounge. I'm Jeremiah. This is going to be amazing. So we're so excited. This is a live taping. This is unlike another session. So we're so excited that you can be part of this. This is the Science Will Win podcast, The Future of Cancer. In this live taping, we're going to talk about how AI is impacting healthcare. You know, 30 years ago, we never thought that AI would be something real and tangible. But today, it is something we can touch. It's visceral, and it's going to be changing healthcare. So we're going to be reimagining how the AI revolution can help change the trajectory of cancer as we know it. I'm going to be your moderator and host today. I'm Jeremiah Aoyang, general partner of the AI Fund at Blitzscaling Ventures. And you might recognize my voice from the Science Will Win podcast series on season 3. I'm also joined by a star-studded panel. To my left, we have Mema, the founder and CEO of Tiger Lily Foundation. A round of applause. We also have Ed Cox, head and general manager of digital health and medicines at Pfizer. We also have Julie Gerberding, CEO of the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health. Welcome, team. Well, let's start with some introductions. Mema, maybe you can kick things off and tell us about you and your background and your passions, your amazing background.
Thanks, Jeremiah. Is this good? Can y'all hear me? Woo! Go, okay. So I am Mema Carmo. I am an 18-year survivor as of last week, Friday, February 28th. Learned I had breast cancer at a very young age, and I was told I only had 5 years to live, but I'm still here 18 years later. Tiger Lily was founded by me while I was in getting my chemotherapy infusion. I was laying there thinking, if I have 5 years to live, what can I manifest to help to change outcomes for women who are younger, who are brown and black, and who are getting underrepresented in healthcare? I'm also a justice warrior and a unicorn, and I love to challenge things that are not working for patients and reimagine as a unicorn solutions for our populations. Thanks for having me here today.
Thank you, Mema. Ed.
Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for coming out. I know there's a lot of really cool things people could be doing here, but I feel that nothing could be more fun or important than this. So my name is Ed Cox. I'm the head and GM of Digital Health and Medicines at Pfizer. I've had the good fortune of being there just over a year, and the unit that I lead is just about a year old, so it's a very new venture for Pfizer. Previously, I had a lot of roles within health, but probably the most relevant was I was the chief executive officer and founder of a digital therapeutic in the field of Alzheimer's. And we wound up getting FDA breakthrough status for a digital product in Alzheimer's. And it's I liken Alzheimer's to oncology because there are so many similarities about having the family impact, the caregiver impact, and trying to see everybody involved in a more holistic way. And so I'm tremendously honored that Pfizer asked me to be here, and I'm really glad to be on this panel.
We're so glad you're here as well, Ed. Julie, tell us about yourself.
Thank you, and I'm so happy to be here on this panel with everyone and to see this room full of people on this important subject. I do serve at the Foundation for the NIH, and our main reason for existence as a nonprofit is to help the NIH bring science, new medicines, new vaccines forward to people faster by working in collaboration with people in the private sector, inpatient organizations, and foundations. You might not know it's real hard for the government to work directly with the private sector. So if you want to have team science, you've got to have sort of middleware that helps bring people together. And we really do bring these incredible NIH scientists together with their counterparts in life sciences, including Pfizer, who's a critical partner for us, inpatient organizations, and people like the Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, et cetera. And we build partnerships to tackle pretty hard problems in science, like cancer, in the pre-competitive space. One of the principles of our operation is that our data are open source. So once we have amalgamated important research information, it's available to credible researchers for use. And again, trying to accelerate the bridges to breakthroughs.
Thank you. See, we have a great panel. For those that are listening, the room is packed. There are so many smiling faces. It's so exciting. The energy is here. So panel, I want to go right down the line. Each of you come from a slightly different background when it comes to healthcare and oncology. And I'd love to hear, are you excited about AI when it comes to oncology and healthcare? What do you think the brightest vision is? What are the opportunities at a very high level? Mema, kick us off.
So for me, being a cancer patient, diagnosed at 32 years old, found the lump at 31, they told me I couldn't have breast cancer. I was too young to come back in my 40s and 50s. I would have been dead by now. I had to push for mammography, which came back clean. The technology failed me. I had to push for a biopsy, which then after a year of pushing, I learned I had triple negative breast cancer, which is the most aggressive breast cancer in women, in black women, with a 5-year recurrence rate and double the rate of death as white women. So imagine living your life. You're here at South By, having a great old time, find a lump on your breast, get dismissed, get blown off, and you've done all the right things, but you die because technology wasn't fast enough to adapt to your body. And I've lost hundreds of friends in the past 18 years that I've survived. I lost 2 friends last week. The blessing in AI is that cancer is very tricky, right? You can have the same twins, even have the same kind of treatment and different outcomes because of the genomic differences in your bodies. But with technology, we can better detect differences in people's body, better create personalized medicines, get biomarker testing, improve screening, improve health literacy, improve things that before may have not been possible. When somebody has the right medication fast, the right diagnosis fast, the right screening faster, the right treatment faster, they have a better chance at life. And so AI is going to help people have better lives and better quality of life and longer life. My daughter just finished high school a few years ago. She's now 21 years old. She was 3 when I was diagnosed. And I used to be afraid that I may not get to see her learn to ride a bike, meet her first boyfriend, go to prom and walk across the graduation stage. As a mother, that's all you want, to see your babies and to be able to smell and hold them. I want to give other mothers that same gift that God's given to me. And AI can make that possible, right, for other patients.
I mean, it's kind of hard to follow that, but we're really glad you're here. Ed, what are the opportunities, your vision for AI in oncology?
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of a fascinating time right now because, you know, AI is one of a series of technologies that have all come about under a real short period of time. And so when I think about it is how much the world has changed in less than 4 years. And one of the ways that you think about it is, you know, 4 years ago, none of us really used telehealth en masse, and now all of us are. We trained the whole world on a complex, multi-step, at-home diagnostic called a COVID test. All of us can now stream things. And so there's a series of things, like underlying technologies that needed to come about, broadband, smartphones becoming ubiquitous, and I think AI is the next component of that. I don't think you could have had generative AI, large language models, to be this powerful even a few years ago, but also people didn't think about health in the same way a few years ago. It was sort of an afterthought versus front of mind. The orientation of how we need to think about digital health and AI as it relates to oncology is deeply person-focused, right? I mean, it's fun and it's cool and it's sci-fi, but like if you're not careful, you get too abstracted. Versus, you know, what Mehmah was saying is like the most personal of experiences. And to me, that's the magic, because we can do things that were not possible before while being really interpersonal.
That's a great point. And technology can be personal because we could have that very specific data. Like you said, telehealth, devices we're wearing, and more. Julie, what are the visions that you have for AI, healthcare, and oncology?
Well, first of all, it's just incredibly exciting, but I can't really think of an area of cancer medicine where AI isn't important or soon will be incredibly important. I mean, just you think about the big buckets. First, there's discovery science. How do we find new targets? How do we get that precision understanding of what's the biology of your cancer or your body's response to it? That's big data and structural data and systems biology, and we have to be able to use AI tools to understand and learn from that. But it moves right into the whole phase of precision diagnosis and treatment, all of the technologies, risk projection. And I think ultimately in helping patients understand their journey and participate in it in meaningful ways, doctors aren't really that great at medical translation, and having tools to augment that and help them really understand what is going on and how do they get through all of this information that they get flooded with to really come up with good decisions and confidence and trust in the decisions that they're making. Every single one of these steps is enabled in some way. And I think we're just at the 0.5 phase of this. We'll soon be rapidly accelerating it.
Thank you, Julie. Mehmah, what of your important focuses is on making sure that everybody has equal access to AI, healthcare, oncology. Maybe you could touch about what is important that the industry needs to focus on.
How much time do you have?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's important that as we put in place AI, we can't forget the human connection, because a lot of things have been done to people who are Black and brown that have been, that I'm an African. I came here as a first generation immigrant that I learned about and I was horrified. I think for me, it's been to be able to apply empathy in every situation. Industry is doing a fantastic job to innovate. There's more patient-centric engagement, but don't call me to be engaged when you already have your plan in place, right? Call me to engage before you even want to invest in that trial. I can tell when you're coming into a community because you want something. I call it a seagull approach. You come down, get the fish, and then get back in the air. Seagulls come in, they're like, I'm hungry, I want that fish, I'm going to get it, right? And they get out. But, you know, one of our sponsors recently supported us to do a clinical trial trust building activity where they invested almost $1 million in Tiger Lily to build a truly community engaged activity. We're in 20 cities on the ground. We were going in communities, going in the poor communities, going into community centers, asking questions. We're showing what it's like to be in a clinical trial and talking about data and AI, which is really important, right? We tell people that it's important to understand why biomarker testing works, because in communities that don't trust in physicians, they're not going to go to a hospital, right? So they won't have their biomarker to be able to detect what kind of cancer they may have and better treat the cancer. But with EHRs being in, you know, being out there, they can now assess population data for those who are in the hospital system database, whether they're seeing a doctor or not, and be able to get that data to be able to really earmark people. I feel like also, there are a lot more patients now who are like myself, who are not taking it that we're only a patient. We're educating people through our ANGEL program in terms of science, research, data, biomarker testing, clinical trials. So they're now partnering with industry, like many of you, with Pfizer, to build solutions that are going to work for, with, and by the patient. That's going to be really empowering to build trust in AI as well, because people are always asking to, where is our data going? What's it being done with? Is it being used to our advantage as well? And we know that the data, garbage in data is garbage out data. So how are we putting patients in a position of power to assess that what's going into these AI systems is going to benefit Black and brown people?
And also incomplete data, right?
Incomplete data as well, right. Yeah. That's our job, to keep them honest, keep everybody honest.
Julie, when we're talking about data and also talking to many people around the industry, you have a very unique vantage point in the market. You're speaking to practically the whole industry. What are you hearing? What are people saying from your view?
You know, let me just follow up on this data point, because I think one of the real values of the collaboration is the accumulation of a much broader set of data and an important effort to make sure that is good quality data, which really, really does matter. You know, when you're using AI tools, the reliability of the output really does depend on the priors, what goes in, and the more that goes in of high quality, the more likely the output is to be meaningful and relevant and predictive, etc. So by working together, there is an incentive to improve, all boats float a little higher, I guess is the way we think of it. But there's some challenges there, because EHRs, the health records that you're talking about, are all over the map. We don't have standards across health systems. We certainly don't have standards across research. FDA and NIH and other HHS agencies right now are working on how to create improvement in data standards across the Department of Health and Human Services, but we're a long way from making that easy. Now, obviously, AI can help with that data integration and mapping, but it's a long, crunching process right now. And yet, people find that incredibly valuable. We reviewed with one of our industry partners who said they have 18 people working on the data that have been generated from some of our studies. So it is important to be able to share.
Yeah, I think though where data could be really important is to be proactive. We'll be able to tell if we use AI properly where there are the hottest spots in the country that have the highest disparities in like real-time data. Imagine being able to preempt by knowing where the hot spots are, where to also target by partnering with advocacy on determinants of health, right? Looking at transportation, looking at food, looking at people's ability to leave their jobs. I mean, I was 31 years old. My boss was like, you can go to treatment for 6 months, but after that, want you back in the office. I was 30 years old, in menopause. My husband left. I was exhausted. And so, like, there's things we can be able to target patients with, even with information on how to advocate for yourself as you get, when you get a diagnosis. And putting in place solutions for barriers to overcome those determinants of health as well.
Yeah, I think the data elements that will ultimately probably prove to be the most relevant are the social determinants of health, because it is those determinants that really set the stage and explain. It's not race. It's really your biology that is affected by the stress level in your lives and the community environments and the stresses and strains that you have that are so unequally distributed in our society. So we have to understand and be able to measure those. Not easy, but again, something that's inconsistently done across electronic health records or personal health records. Standardization will help.
This is a great conversation. So let's fast forward. We have a lot of this data. We're achieving the goals that you set forth, Mema. Julie, we're working across the industry. Ed, I'd like you to comment around how AI, assuming we have this type of data, can help digital health at a broader level.
I think one of the things that I always say where the power of digital health can be is empathy at scale. And I mean that in a real specific way, in that, you know, we were talking about this before, no two people have the same combination of apps on their phone, right? We all have different experiences and we all use them in different ways. And yet, so it is an incredibly personal experience. And being a cancer patient or being a cancer caregiver is an incredibly personal experience. Your experience is just yours. And digital is this really personal thing. And yet it's also scaled, right? There's 6 billion smartphones in the world. When you think about these solutions, they are in the hundreds of millions. And so somehow we've connected these two things to be something, maybe the most personal thing you have. Maybe the very first thing you look at when you wake up in the morning. I try to look at my wife first and then my phone, but like it's 50-50. So you're talking about the most personal thing maybe in your whole world is your digital devices. And yet they are scaled in a way that nothing else in human history has really ever done, you know, maybe with the exception of books. And so I think that that's really, really thrilling and exciting. And I also think where the power of AI can be is in some ways in these very crunchy kind of things that makes everyone's person and everyone's experience a little bit better. So a good example is there's so much around the data, there's so much about the optimization and grinding, but I think we're going to get to a point that the admins in hospitals and the admins in care centers have AI support that will just make their life better. And that's the thing, is if we just made everyone in the stack's life 3 or 4 or 5% better, that's going to have this really profound effect. And so to me, I think AI is not the last breakthrough, but it is the most recent breakthrough to take digital health to the next scale, because health is never going to get less digital. No way, right? It's a one-way street, and I think this is a real powerful way to do that.
Thank you for that. Let's talk about kind of a potentially scary future around how AI could be used. And I want to introduce the crowd to the topic of a term called synthetic data. Now, if you're not familiar with this, this is happening in the AI industry where AI creates images. You've heard of Midjourney or DALL-E, or synthetic text. OpenAI, GPT creates that content. What we're seeing in like the marketing industry is marketers are testing their marketing campaigns on generated customers called synthetic customers. What we're going to see, and we're already starting to see, is synthetic data for patients or anticipating how would people react to potential clinical trials, or how would patients react to marketing campaigns from healthcare companies or pharmaceuticals. And I wanted to get the panel's feedback on synthetic data as it's quickly coming to the forefront. Maybe Julie, do you have a comment on that? We'll get to everybody.
Well, my first comment is bad word, synthetic.
Oh, yeah. What would be better?
let's think about that. I mean, I think already we're seeing where you can do twinning studies, where maybe you have a patient, but you can find a control, sort of amalgamated control, who has all the characteristics of that patient except the one thing you're trying to study. So it's already happening, but I think we need to have a lot of conversation about what that really means and how we're going to validate it. And I'm sure the FDA is going to have a lot of conversations on what they do with clinical trial data that are coming from synthetic people.
I think those are great points. Ed, synthetic data.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is we need to not get hyped by our own jargon, right? Like there is obviously synthetic data that's real, that's going to be out there. But again, it goes to about what I was saying at the beginning, is there are so many very viable uses of AI that are much more straightforward. And I think if what we're saying is, it's like, look, we can call it whatever we want, but if we're just processing data faster, that is a good organic step along the way. If we're using any kind of technology to get further from the person, then regardless of what the technology is, then that's not good. And so the thing is that AI is a tool. It's just a tool. It's like anything else. It's a hammer or a screwdriver. And if we imagine it is this thing unto itself, you know, I mean, hammers are not self-aware, right? And so, like, it is a tool that can be used in a way. And I think if we are just obsessed about saying, like, how would I explain this to my mom in the kitchen? How would I explain this to my little girl? If that's the way that we're thinking about it, and AI is a tool that facilitates that, then it's a force for good. But I think that if you work backwards from that moment, and then one tool, you know, large language models, generative AI, you know, structural AI, traditional AI, they're just different tools that you're using, but working backwards from the patient and the caregiver and the human.
I love what you mentioned about, again, I love the word empathy that you mentioned earlier. We know the healthcare workforce is burned out, right? They're so burned out. My mom was a nurse. She would work 12 and 16, 18 hour shifts, right? But after the pandemic, people are seeing even like colonoscopy screenings are like months, years behind what they're due, right? So having AI support healthcare workers, to me, that's empathy for the human being with the technology. That's a win for me, right? We're seeing AI could cut healthcare costs to better detect, you know, adverse events, improve referrals, automate authorization, and other processes. I love that, but when you pair it with a human, at the end of the day, when you go to a doctor appointment for anything, what do you want the most? Someone has to hold your hand. That's when you can breathe. So I think the beauty is marrying empathy with the electronic, the technology. That's where the win's going to be for all of us.
Ed, let's talk more about the practical applications for AI in an everyday scenario. So you kind of touched on this, but for example, imagine a mother who was just diagnosed with cancer. How can AI just help them in a practical way?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is that, and I understand why we came to this point, but there's still a lot of processes that are extremely manual, and there's even a lot of paper, like still printed paper, that is walking someone through this moment. So someone goes in and like the worst news they've ever had, right? It was like when Devin was speaking earlier today, right? About when he got the news about his little girl. It was like it shattered his world, right? Any of us who've had a loved one that got that diagnosis, it shatters their world and shatters ours. And then what happens is someone probably hands you a big packet of paper, right? Which is understandable, but I mean, my gosh. And so I think these are ways in which AI, and I know I sound like a broken record, but it's because it's the right thing to advocate for, is that if the way that we're walking a mom, my mom, through this journey, or my daughter through this journey, is with AI as a guide, AI as a way to frame it, AI as a way to point you to the best information, or maybe someday point you to the best clinical trials, or it's there in this tool. I mean, people feel emotionally concussed. It's like they got hit by a car and they're stumbling out of it. And anything that we can do to put power and information at their fingertips in the moment they need that is going to profoundly change that first window. And those are all examples that I think AI can do today. There's no technological change for that.
Thank you, Ed. Julie, you work across the industry, so let's talk about collaboration. You worked in academia, government, and across the healthcare space. Do you see maybe there's some ways that AI can help collaboration amongst those groups, just like the practical examples Ed gave for a patient?
I do, but I just want to add to what Ed said is that when someone's concussed, usually information isn't what they need. What they need is empathy. They need that, you know, that coming together. And what's nice about an AI solution in that context is later, when they've had a chance to process, they won't remember anything that got said except the one big thing that they were told, but they can go back and find hopefully a patient-friendly, you know, resource that will help them get the information they need. I think as a society that's just coming out of a terrible phase of a pandemic, we're craving empathy. We don't see it in very many parts of our world right now. So that to me is the big takeaway message in all this, is AI-enabled empathy. That would be the ultimate goal. But to your question about collaboration and what's been learned, you know, what's been reassuring to me, having moved through these different sectors, is how aligned we really are. You know, there are all kinds of stigmas about working for big pharma, or, you know, the government is slow, or academicians are out of touch. At the end of the day, there is passion to solve these problems, and people know the tools are at hand. We can feel the science and the possibility of the science. So the passion is what I think really motivates the collaboration and gets people up in the morning, and it's the patient community that really gives us that visible incentive. So it's a really spirited time for really, really amazing collaboration.
Yeah, I mean, to one of the points that Julie made is, this is one of the only industries that the end result of what we do is someone lives longer. Like, you're literally in the life-saving business. That's magic. That's magic. We could do so many other things, and there are so many other things that are interesting and compelling. But, like, you either want someone to live longer or live better. And, like, the idea that every single day we get to wake up as all of us that are touching healthcare, right? All of us are touching healthcare. The end result of what we do is try to save people's lives. And, like, what an inspiring thing. I mean, cancer is a terrible dragon. Mini dragons even, and they all deserve to be slayed. So that's why we have unicorns, and that's why we have knights, and that's why we have all kinds of other mythical ways to think about ourselves, because waking up every day and saying, okay, this new AI, okay, AI is maybe Excalibur, it's not me, but it's a tool, can I use this today where the end result is someone lives longer or lives better. And that is more than we could ever ask for when you think about inspiring yourself, because that's a critical part of this.
You're getting really positive feedback from the crowd on that, Ed. Maeve, I actually want to touch upon one of the comments you made earlier, and let's really expand on it. And I'd like to hear your thought on how we can be more focused on preventative before somebody becomes sick, and if AI plays a role in that.
I had a friend of mine who, she had breast cancer twice. She recovered both times. Her cancer had returned, metastatic. She called me, and when I went to the hospital, it was everywhere. So I spent every day with her until she died. She died in 2.5 weeks. And that's something that's been one of the most shocking things I've ever experienced. How could AI have helped better change her trajectory of her journey? Could it have helped her doctor know how to monitor, you know, what's happening in her body before it happens, right? That's where the power of AI is. So how are we democratizing AI and who's getting it and how it's working for those populations? I think for me, the real power has been for me as healthcare changes, people who are healthcare workers are tired, they're worn out, overburdened, is the patient's voice is everything. You have to understand the importance of asking the right questions. Here's what they are, going to the right places, knowing what to do. And to me, AI can help people better get the right questions and answers faster. And so getting patients educated about what to ask for, when to ask for it, and then to be able to have access to those tools is really, really important as well.
Julie, picking up on what Maima said, let's talk about patient-centric innovation. So you're the CEO of FNIH. How do you prioritize patient-centric innovation when it comes to oncology?
You know, when I was at Merck, I was the chief patient officer of the company, and so I learned a lot. Since I trained on the front lines of HIV, my patients were my best teachers, so I know to go to the patients when you need to understand something. But I really hadn't thought of it as sort of an end-to-end process. So, you know, it's a process of asking, learning. I used to go to small round tables, for example. I had to be in California for something. I would ask, could I meet with some of the patient organizations in the community? Tell me what your experience is with our company. What should we be doing better? Where are we doing a good job? Where are we missing the boat? So you have to really have someone who stands strong for that. And I think in cancer, it's more important than in any other aspect of medicine because it is so frightening. And you're dealing with people whose lives are being prematurely, you know, cut off in the best years of their life in many cases. So defining what patient centricity really means is, in my opinion, just caring about the patient and really making sure that that's the first thing you think about and the last thing you think about at the end of the day. In an organization like the one I'm operating under, we are also on a learning curve, and we've done some of the easy steps. We've created a patient council. We've invited patients to participate in helping us decide what projects we should be taking on. We are including the patients on the governance committees of our clinical trial design so that they're actually meaningfully participating, not just checking a box that we have a patient in the room. And we have a monthly meeting of everyone in the organization that always starts with someone describing their lived experience with one of the illnesses that we're addressing, because it brings people back in touch with, oh yes, that is that passion that we have in the work that we do. Sometimes you just have to be reminded because you get caught up in all the day-to-day stuff. But I don't think I've seen an organization yet that has this figured out. I think I've seen some organizations that are working really hard with patients and their caregivers and advocates to try to continuously improve. And that's what I'm aiming to do. Let's keep learning and keep talking. And the candid conversation really matters. I know you do that at Pfizer also. It's really important that you have those conversations. And sometimes they're really hard to listen to.
Ed, you're a leader. You've heard this, the input and the great ideas from the panelists around you. Love to hear your philosophy. What principles do you have when it comes to leadership to drive innovation and to what you were saying, empathy with AI?
Yeah, I think like any kind of job, if you do it long enough, things become patterns, and sometimes you kind of forget what you're doing or why. And then I also think that within the field of life science, because so many things aren't successful, so many things don't eventually get to market, people can get fatigued, people can get bummed out, they can get discouraged. And so I think from a leadership standpoint, when I'm leading my team, there's a couple things that I try to drive back to, is that one, rehumanizing what we're doing. You know, lots of times companies try to do that, but I think on an individual leader level, you can do that. You can do that by understanding your team and their families and what they've gone through, and you make it personal for them, right? The other thing is kind of what, you know, the monologue I did a few moments ago is like, be romantic about it. Like, remember that you're doing important work, that the outcome of the important work is probably the greatest outcome of any work that could be done. And lots of times people forget that. They like say, oh, I work for a corporation. No, you work in the business of saving lives. That's what you do. And lots of times people just, it hasn't occurred to them. It's not like once they hear it, they disagree. It's just, they just haven't thought about it. You just kind of get into a job and then you, you know, work on it, and some things work and some things fail, but it all begins to feel abstract. And so I think from a leader, part of what is powerful is making it all feel real to that person, because if they really get that, if they really realize what it is that they get to do every day, it is incredibly compelling and an easy way to inspire people, because it's inspiring. And so for me, that's more than anything else, it's understanding people and also removing roadblocks. As a great leader, I think the two things, maybe three things you can do is lay out incredibly great strategy, passionately pour into your team, and remove anything that's blocking your team. And that's universally true. And so I'm fortunate I work in an industry that it's easy to get someone passionate if they really think that the end result is life-saving.
Team. I'm going to call you team now because we're all working together, right? So I work in the tech industry, Silicon Valley. I invest in the AI startups. You know, I talk to the big tech companies. I want your advice. What should the tech industry, who you're in some cases dependent on to accomplish these goals, what should we do better? And then I'll have a final question for you as a follow-up. What advice do you give to the tech industry? Anybody?
Okay, I think I got defaulted on being the expert, which is always a dangerous place. I think something that they're beginning to do, but I would advocate that they do more, is lean in, right? Like, health is a still somewhat new sector for all these big tech companies. They're sort of operating on the fringes. Some more than others. But if you think about it, it's maybe the only sector that influences or that impacts every single human on the planet, right? And so it's the kind of thing that I think big tech and technology startups even, the more that they are saying, okay, this matters to us, we need to stand up divisions with this, we need to be intentional about our thinking, and not that it's an afterthought, but it's a forethought, I think that that's huge. And then from the startup standpoint, I would say this, is most startups have founders that have very specific life experiences. And sometimes that makes it, creates a pretty big blind spot to the patient life experience.
That's right. Most of the founders are white and Asian men.
Yeah, well, and not only that, most of them are young and probably healthy, right? Like a really good example is, you know, I'll just take 10 seconds, but like there are very few technology companies in the field of Alzheimer's because almost no tech startups have ever been around Alzheimer's patients. Why? Different age brackets, a whole series of other things. It's the same thing, is that typically if someone is a digital health startup in the field of cancer, it's because someone close to someone died. And that is sort of that's the spark, that's the origin, but they may not spend as much time in the life of the patient as they need. And so it goes back to this idea that like if you're inventing solutions, but you're not inventing solutions that the person really desperately needs. And so those are the two. Is one, big tech, please lean in. Startup, you know, get in the life of the patient to understand them better.
I just want to add a probably unpopular follow-on to that, and that is that I'm going to wear my doctor hat. If you have patients coming in with their self-generated health data on this app, then on that app, this ring, this device, it's totally unstandardized. And you have the difficult challenge of having to interpret a universe of startup tech data coming in all sorts of formats and sorts. So you'd really would struggle to make use of that information in making decisions or helping that patient understand their decisions. So I'm kind of pushing for some standardization. I know that sounds anti-competitive, but I think we do need to kind of help the industry come to some agreements on at least the most important core measures so that you know that you're apples to apples, oranges to oranges.
I want to see that a part of the money is going towards patient groups. For things like clinical trials, right, we see that there's lack of Black women in clinical trials. How can the tools be used to get more Black women in clinical trials? So that's what I want to see more investment in, not just how can I sleep better, eat better, work out better. I want more apps that are helping people to solve specific measurable actions that lead to equitable outcome that are sustainable.
Well thought out. My last question for the esteemed panel is, paints a vision for the audience on how AI is going to help oncology and healthcare 5 years out from now.
I'll go first to stall for the rest of the panel. I think it's easier to imagine what it looks like 10 years from now than five. All right. So I think if we're talking about 10 years from now, you're talking about digital health is ubiquitous in every corner of the world, right? Anywhere there's connectivity, anywhere there's a smartphone, people are getting world-class health because they have connectivity and they have a smartphone. That's a huge step. And then I think, especially at the intersection of new treatments and how AI informs us to deploy those to a lot of the things that Memo was saying, better diagnostics, better screening, better, you know, stratifying. I think that there's going to be a whole series of cancers that today are viewed as death sentences that we view as containable problems. And we've got other indications that we can look at. Julie was talking about her experience in HIV. Like you can go from something that is like, I mean, it's still horrible. It's still a, you know, very life impacting thing. But as we're moving these diagnoses from, okay, I think I'm going to die, to the default of cancer is like, all right, that's definitely not good. But my default thought won't be that I'm going to die. I think if we can get to that point, that when someone hears that, it's just as bad. But, or, you know, it's still very bad, but it's not like the instant thought that we all feel, which is like, I'm going to die, versus this is scary, but I'm going to live.
I would just take it a step further. In 10 years, I think we're going to be using cure as the word in our vocabulary when we make a diagnosis of cancer, because I think that the precision diagnosis and the precision treatment is going to progress that rapidly, where we will really begin to understand the biology and we will know what drugs and when and how to keep up with chemo resistance and so forth. So I think it's cure, not for everything probably realistically, but for a lot.
For me, I think that my goal or my dream is that Tiger Lily won't exist to treat people with cancer, but to empower, uplift, support, and encourage badass women to do great things for their families and have a better quality of life. I mean, you said what I was going to say, right? I think that imagine all the money going into healthcare, going into life care and empathy in healthcare and quality of life and eradicating determinants of health and barriers. Not just in, you know, the other things, right, which are important now. So the word cure will be a word that we all use, not death, in that the money will go into quality of life, fun, joy, family, memories, and we'll see other mothers seeing their daughters walk across stages with their tassels turned to the other side, thrown in the air, and celebrating what family means to us all.
Thank you all for coming. This has been a live taping of the Science Will Win podcast, the future of cancer, or should we say, the future of cure. Thank you so much, South by Southwest.